I have talked about three closely related ways in which a government exercises its powers: coercion, protection, and subsidisation. Let me now sum up what I have said. Each such power, I suggested, has its limitations. Some of these limitations apply to any government anywhere. Take coercion. No government can coerce its citizens into being imaginative, and imagination lies at the heart of every creative enterprise, whether in industry, art, or science. Some limitations will vary with circumstances. Without ceasing to be democratic, a democratic government cannot engage in forms of coercion which an authoritarian government takes for granted. As for protection, there will be ills against which no government can protect its citizens. They arise out of human ignorance, or human limitations, or the operation of natural laws. Other ills a particular government will not be able to protect against without bringing to ruin the social system on which it depends. Each of these powers, one can add, has its darker side. By its very nature, coercion is in itself an evil. It is a necessary evil insofar as without the help of governmental coercion, a community is not able to go about its business or enjoy its pleasures in reasonable security. Yet coercion can also be used in order to destroy our freedom to do so. As for its other powers, by protecting, as by subsidizing, a government can enlarge the range of activities which are available to individuals. It can help to make possible the emergence or the continuance of voluntary associations. But it can also, deliberately or inadvertently, reduce its citizens to the condition of slaves, destroying their capacity for independent action and the voluntary organizations through which that capacity finds expression. Setting out to protect, a government can create a form of society in which atomized individuals, their organizations destroyed, are at the mercy of a government against which there is no protection. One could tell a similar story, if time permitted, about other government powers, about their power to persuade, about their control over information. But rather than exploring such themes, let us now turn our attention to the Australian scene and ask how what I have been saying bears upon it. Our attitude to government has traditionally been a rather complicated one. On the one hand, we automatically turn to government for help in an emergency, to protect and to subsidise. We do this however we are. Academics, farmers, businessmen have this much in common. It seems to us very natural, too, to cope with a social problem by legislation. There ought to be a law about it, we say with indignation. The total number of acts passing through Australian legislative bodies in a single year, so I have credibly been told, approaches the 1,000 mark. There is not a single citizen of Australia, I feel confident, however law-abiding he may think of himself as being, who has not broken the law, not once, but hundreds of times. Our law courts are clogged. Organisations find it necessary to protect themselves by engaging lawyers rather than more directly productive staff, as universities may be forced in self-protection to engage lawyers rather than scientists and scholars. Each separate legislative act may have its justification, but the multiplicity of regulations destroys the efficiency of regulation. Yet we go on lawmaking as if its social costs simply did not exist. There is a quite general principle here. Ask a government to do too much, and the really important decisions are not made or are inadequately considered. But if in Australia we turn far too readily to governments for protection or assistance by regulation, it is still true that on the other side we display a marked mistrust for government. That is apparent in our political institutions. In some measure, of course, every democracy mistrusts government. That is precisely why democracies have free elections with opposition parties, open parliamentary debates, independent news media, a relaxed censorship, freedom of information. If these institutions operate in an imperfect fashion, there is still no mistaking their general intent to limit the powers of government. Nevertheless, Australia carries mistrust for governments beyond what democracy inevitably demands. Further than it is carried in, let us say, Great Britain and New Zealand, if not in every respect, as far as it is carried in the United States. Our elections, to take one case, are held every 3 years, where 4 or 5 years is the more normal period of office. Furthermore, when we elect a government, we by no means say to it, "There you are now, do as you choose." A new government is slotted into a set of pre-existing institutions, judicial, administrative, coercive, over which it has only a limited degree of control. Take the federal government. Its legislation in the federal sphere has to be approved not only by a lower house, as in all democracies, but by a Senate with real teeth. Even then, it may be ruled unconstitutional by the High Court, to say nothing of the powers of the Governor-General. Only by referenda can a government loosen the bonds imposed upon it by the federal constitution, and voters in such referenda have been conspicuously unready to agree to proposals which would enlarge the government's powers. Regular elections, constitutional rules, federalism, these are by no means the only ways in which we limit the powers of our governments. Our suspicion of government also finds expression in our fondness for statutory authorities and public companies. Even when an organisation is largely or totally funded by governments, we do not always bring it under the direct control of the public service, we do not subject it to government control in its day-to-day activities, we do not administer it in the manner which we take to be typical of government-run services, that is, bureaucratically. Our government-funded radio and television stations, to take a case, are governed by a commission. They are not under the direct supervision of a ministry. That, of course, is the government's doing. But in Australia, even governments mistrust governments. If they do not mistrust themselves, they mistrust their possible successors. By this indirect method of rule, governments both assuage the qualms of electors and diminish the power of subsequent regimes. Not only do we traditionally subdue the immediacy of government control in the life of the community by the device of statutory authorities, we permit, in a great many instances, commercial competition against government-funded enterprises. We display, indeed, an exceptional fondness for that type of dual arrangement, which, so far as I know, no political theorist, no political party has ever explicitly advocated. We have private and government banks, insurance companies, airlines, hospitals, schools, broadcasting and television stations, travel agents, theatrical entrepreneurs, bookshops. Encountering so broad a range of governmental activities, American observers often describe our society as socialistic, whereas in the eyes of continental observers, not necessarily from Eastern Europe, we are a strange people indeed in funding a government enterprise and yet permitting competition to it and not subjecting it to direct government control. It is stranger still in their eyes when, as often happens, the competitor is government subsidized, or at the very least assisted with loans and protected against further competition in a manner which can indeed approach the farcical, as in the two airline system. In yet another respect, not so readily specifiable, we limit the power of our governments by our attitudes as distinct from our laws. In many societies, the strength of a government depends at least partly on the fact that it possesses a special charisma. It is thought of as being, in some sense, holy, sacred, so that criticism, let alone rebellion, is sacrilegious. Emperors and kings have often sought to represent themselves as being divine beings, as gods, descended from gods, or at the very least, as ruling by divine right. Democracy in England arose out of a rejection of that view. Governments were conceived of as secular devices for protecting contracts. But attempts were still made to bestow some charismatic legitimacy on governments by suggesting that they represent the general will, or the people as a whole, or some mysterious metaphysical entity called the state, or the proletariat become conscious of its true nature. Or perhaps that by becoming the government, the politicians who make it up have divested themselves of all particular interests and now wholly concern themselves with the national interest, whatever that is supposed to be. In one way or another, a government is turned into something not merely powerful but grand, peculiarly deserving of our respect and loyalty, not merely because half the population many of them with distinct reservations, has voted for it, but for some deeper metaphysical reason. In Australia, the charismatic power of government, by international and historical standards, stands very low. Much of the charisma attaches to a royal family 12,000 miles away. Its reflection at Yarralumla is feeble indeed. Our Prime Minister does not possess the charismatic authority of the French or even the American President. It is characteristic of our way of thinking that we are about to construct a Parliament House which, instead of standing grandly on top of a hill, burrows into that hill so that one can actually walk over it. Nothing could more accurately depict the Australian spirit. Yet even that Parliament House has been condemned as too grand. Professor Manning Clark laments our lack of a sense of grandeur and does what he can to impose grandeur upon us, whether by elevating our past or by envisaging for us an apocalyptically conceived future. But some of us see our lack of grandeur as a cause for self-congratulation and would not welcome a republic out of a fear that we might come to attach a reverential authority to a president. It is our historic task to show the world what can be created by a resolute pursuit of mediocrity. I mean mediocrity in the original sense of that word, the full recognition that we are all human beings with all the limitations of human beings. We're none of us superhuman. We are not gods in the making, our government no more than the rest of us. It is not necessary to agree with Tom Paine that the trade of governing has always been monopolized by the most ignorant and the most rascally individuals of mankind. Some of our politicians are reasonably well informed and no more dishonest than the rest of us. We do well to think of them in this way, as none of them saints and few of them scoundrels. They are not parasites, just as public servants are not parasites. Their role in our society is a very important one, and the best of them work very hard to fulfill it. But it is as dangerous to think too well of them as it is to think too badly of them. Common sense, astringency, a refusal to take pretension seriously, these are the qualities for which we are valued in the councils of the world, and I hope it will always be so. No doubt these virtues can degenerate into cynicism, or into mediocrity in the bad sense of the word, a loss of any ability to distinguish what will just pass muster, she'll do, we say, and the genuinely good, a refusal to try to accomplish what lies well within our powers, let alone what will stretch them to the utmost. But understood as I have understood it, our mediocrity is our saving grace. So far I have been developing my original claim that in Australia we mistrust governments. Then how are we to account for the proliferation of our government enterprises? In the United States, after all, there's no government broadcasting, there are no government trading banks, no government airlines, to take only the most obvious instances. Well, if we mistrust governments, we also mistrust private enterprise. Many of us read with sympathy Adam Smith's remark that people of the same trade seldom meet together, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public. That is the other side to our fondness for an arrangement by which government enterprises compete with private enterprises. It is a way of mistrusting private enterprise and government simultaneously. One must add, as illustrating our mistrust of private enterprise, the sufficiently obvious point that it is in any case restricted by a formidable array of legislative and administrative rules designed to protect the worker, the consumer, the environment, or some more vaguely conceived national interest. To sum up, the majority of Australians, there are of course many individual exceptions, have not been won over by either of the two most sharply delineated political philosophies, libertarianism on the one hand and totalitarianism on the other hand, even in the form of state socialism. Let us consider, nevertheless, how a full-blooded libertarian would respond to the Australian situation as I have described it. He would look favourably on the restrictions we have imposed on government. Indeed, he would wish to strengthen them, as we saw, by introducing constitutional amendments of the same general sort as the American Bill of Rights. He would add to them amendments which would limit the total expenditure of governments, compelling them to balance their budgets, to restrict their total expenditure, with allowances, of course, for special circumstances. You can find a set of proposals of this sort in the appendix to Milton Friedman's book, Free to Choose. I do not think that these proposals should be dismissed out of hand as worthless, difficult though they may be to implement. A despotic government can destroy our rights. A spendthrift government can lead us into an inflation from which it can be difficult, even impossible, to recover. Yet I have reservations, as I have already made plain, about the necessity and the desirability of the first of them, the Bill of Rights. The limitation on the spending powers of government, similarly, might greatly diminish its flexibility in rapidly changing circumstances. If both proposals nevertheless deserve serious consideration, it is as emphasising the kinds of limitation which, in a democratic society, a government ought to regard as tacitly binding upon it, to leave us free and to restrain its spending. What else would a libertarian say as he looked at our society? He would not at all like our habit of running to the government for subsidy. I agree, as I have already made plain, that there are grave dangers in doing so. There are at least three advantages in obtaining our ends by voluntary organisations, supported by private donations, rather than by government handouts. The first advantage is that the running of such organisations gives individuals an opportunity to learn the arts of cooperation, to exhibit imagination and initiative, to stand in closer relationships to their fellow human beings. The second advantage is that their activities are not subject to the fickleness of government, which is as ready to withdraw support as to offer it. And a third advantage is the piper calls the tune, will move from subsidizing to controlling, subverting the original intention of the organization. These grounds are not strong enough, I however argued, to allow the deduction that the government should withdraw from subsidising, that it should never, that is, transfer income from taxpayers in order to subsidise activities. The voluntary activity may simply not be able to survive without subsidy, and its loss would have the effect that our society would lose its diversity, that valuable activities would no longer take place in it. The libertarian would also object to our social services. They too were once left to voluntary effort. Anybody who believes that this was the ideal state of affairs had better read George Orwell's Down and Out in London and Paris. If he grumbles about the indifference or hostility of bureaucrats, he might also recall that the phrase cold as charity predates the welfare state. So far as social services are employed as a way of helping the handicapped, in a manner which relieves the suffering of those who are incapable of helping themselves and assists those who can partially help themselves to maintain maximum independence, I am not prepared, as I have already said, to support the libertarian case against them. But it is also true that, as they argue, social service policies have often been notably unsuccessful in obtaining their ends. They are too often motivated not by a desire to relieve suffering or to turn dependence into independence, but by a totally insane attempt to equalise, even between relatively well-off citizens. To equalise, for example, by reducing the need for them to sacrifice part of their income to support children whom other people on the same income do not have to support. Often enough, the effect has been that the low-income taxpayer has had to meet the expense of the relatively well-off. The libertarian argument should at least provoke us into looking very carefully at our support programs, examining their necessity and their effectiveness. One of the major problems, as I see it, is to distribute such support only to those who really need it, without making use of means tests which are both undignified and costly to police. Here is a field where there is clear need for practical inventiveness. One other aspect of our society a libertarian would certainly object to. We have government enterprises, even when we permit competition from private enterprise. Much of the libertarian's criticism is based on the assumption, derived from American experience, that government enterprises are bound to be badly run. This, I have suggested, is simply not true. It's particularly not true when the enterprise is permitted the degree of liberty from civil service regulations which is possessed by statutory authorities and private competition is allowed. But it does not follow either that in every case in which we now do so, we are right to employ this dual system, let alone that it ought to be made universal. we need to look much more closely than we have so far done at the question under what circumstances such private-public competition is desirable, what good it can achieve, what evil it can prevent. We have given the libertarian his head. Now let us consider those who would like to see the power of government extended. They will certainly not be content with the Australian scene as it is. The first thing they commonly want to do is to destroy the federal system by absorbing state governments, so that federal government will be all-powerful except on questions of purely local concern which can be left to municipal bodies. They would abolish the present Senate, and they would not permit the High Court to declare legislation invalid. That implies a confidence in government which I am quite unable to share. But the government, the reply may come, is elected by the people. So it is, or more accurately, as I have several times insisted, by about half the people approving of some elements in the government's policy. But once it is elected, it always, by the nature of the case, does a great many things which it had not announced it would do. It has to respond to changing circumstances, but it may also be corrupted by the experience of power, so corrupted indeed that it takes steps to ensure that it will never have to face the electors again. That has happened elsewhere. It could happen here. In the past, we were saved from a government's attempt to ban the Communist Party by the complexities of our constitutional system. Never trust governments absolutely, and always do what you can to prevent them from doing too much harm. That is the very sound principle which our political system has enshrined. Compared with what governments not only have done, but are doing here and now, in one part of the world or another, Jack the Ripper was an innocent babe in arms. Of course, we hear a lot nowadays about socialism with a human face. But the Soviet Union is right about this. There can be no such thing. Any socialist government which tries to humanize itself will find itself moving in bourgeois directions. The face of bourgeois society, like human faces in general, is no doubt often hideous. I yield to nobody in detesting a great number of its expressions. The greed, cruelty, unscrupulousness, complacency, heartlessness so often visible there. Nevertheless, I still believe that it is the only form of society within which great changes can take place without the apparatus of the concentration camp, murder, the suppression of opposition, the muzzling of the artist, the thinker, the critic, the independently minded worker. Socialism is a paradise for the intellectual who is prepared to conform and for the bureaucrat, but for no one else. To travel out of Hungary, as I recently did, in a train from which the roof panels were removed at the Austrian border, in case some dissident was concealed there trying to escape, is to be reconciled to a great deal in Australia. But such a reconciliation should lead one to be more, not less, wary of threats to liberty in one's own society, threats which can come from any of our political parties. Nor should it lead one to be afraid of change. I am not suggesting that, for example, our present distribution of powers between state and federal governments is ideal. Mr. Hawke was right when he suggested in his Boyer lectures that we ought to be seriously considering changes in our system of government to make it more genuinely representative. But those changes should not be of such a character as to weaken our protection against the rise of tyranny. The full-blooded state socialist, of course, would want to abolish the dual system of competition between private and public by nationalizing the private. I have to confess that I simply cannot understand why at this stage of our social experience anyone should want to nationalize deliberately to create a monopoly. Who can now possibly believe that nationalized monopolies would be more responsive to the public, more efficient, more profitable, offer a better life to their employees, be less subject to industrial disputes? The sole possible justification of national monopolies is in those rare instances where it is not desirable that the user should pay in direct relationship to his use, as it is not desirable for it to cost more to send a private letter from Perth to Brisbane than from one suburb to another. If we believe that governments are so endowed with superior economic knowledge that they can run the economy more effectively than anybody else or than the free market, then we might also be prepared to believe that certain key enterprises should be nationalized. But why should we suppose that governments possess this wisdom? As the German sociologist Max Weber pointed out, politics as a profession attracts a very special class of human being. The most innovative, daring, imaginative, enterprising members of the community do not enter politics. So government control means in practice control by a very special limited class of human beings, political animals, working through bureaucrats. Why should we entrust to them, or indeed to anybody else, even the most gifted, the power to plan our lives? My conclusions will be very unsatisfying to those who like to believe that there is some single sweeping social change that will solve all our problems, whether it be the withdrawal of government or its total supremacy. Substantially, I am defending our mixed economy without for a moment suggesting that we have the mixture right or that we are under no necessity to make any kind of political or social change. If I have some degree of sympathy with the libertarians, it is insofar as they have a genuine enthusiasm for liberty, which, however, their conservative imitators only partially share. Many of the changes we need to make are, I believe, in the libertarian direction. The libertarians accuse me, however, of letting my heart rule my head because I am not prepared to accept their view that 19th century industrial society was a Garden of Eden from which we were expelled for eating the apple of welfare. I grant that when governments do good, it is with the slap of command. Nevertheless, in my judgment, they can sometimes do good, did so in industrial England, have done so in the post-war years here in Australia. Yet we should never forget the limits of government. Governments cannot create liberty, imagination, affection, the desire to understand, the capacity to cooperate, generosity, tolerance. Indeed, governments have good reason for fearing each and every one of these qualities if they are intent on extending their power. That is why we have good reason, in our turn, for fearing governments. No doubt, governments can equalize. But it is no accident that equalizer is American slang for a gun. We can be sure that if we abandon liberty in the name of equality, it will be equality at the point of a gun, equality in misery.